This is continuing in volume 4, and we're starting with September the 21st, 1900. And the subject is the power of obedience. So I want to give you the first 1 Samuel 15, verses 22 to 24, where the prophet told King Saul that obedience is better than sacrifice. I also want to give you Deuteronomy 28, verses 1 to 14. And these are the blessings that are automatic when we give obedience to God in everything. So Louisa says, "Who can tell my affliction in being deprived of my dearest friend, which is suffering?" Now, most of us wouldn't expect that the suffering is the dearest friend, but that's exactly what she says. And we're at a point where the Lord is changing his way of actually dealing with Louisa, and she's finding it very difficult to take. So she said, "I admired the prodigious power of holy obedience, as well as the power which our Lord had in communicating to the confessor, who by obedience and by signing me," that is making the sign of the cross on her forehead, "had freed me from an illness which I considered grave, and which was enough to undo my body. But in spite of this, I could not help feeling the pain of being deprived of suffering, which is so good, which moved blessed Jesus to pity and compassion in such a way that I could make him come almost continuously." Now, Louisa's problem is not the suffering. It's the fact that when she is going through intense sufferings, that Jesus is with her much more intensely than he would be in the normal way. So if the sufferings are taken away, then this very special visitation of Jesus is taken away as well. That's what she's lamenting. So when our Lord came, I lamented to him, saying, "My beloved good, what have you done to me? You had me freed by the confessor, and so I lost the hope of leaving the earth for now." That's 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 10. And in those verses, St. Paul says that he wants to put off the tent of this world and go into eternity, but that he has to stay on because of his mission. And that's Louisa's situation as well. "Besides, why make so many stratagems putting Father in the middle when you could have freed me yourself?" She's still in volume 4 at the point where she doesn't really want the priest to be involved. And Jesus is going to insist on it. And it will become obvious as we go through the volumes as to why that was so absolutely essential. Because the Lord was going to make a completely new revelation of the divine will to Louisa. And the church had to be involved from the beginning, because the church didn't know anything about this up to this particular moment. "Maybe you didn't want to grieve me directly, did you?" she said. And he said, "My daughter, how quickly you have forgotten that obedience was everything to me." That's John 14:31. "I want the world to know that I love the Father, and therefore I do exactly what my Father tells me." And Jesus said, "And I want obedience to be everything for you. Besides, I was the one who put Father in the middle so that you would have regard for him as for my very own person." So she's being told that she needs to give much more attention to the authority of the church. So having said this, he disappeared. And Louisa said she was all embittered. So in the next paragraph, we're dealing with heroic obedience on the part of Louisa. Because what the Lord is trying to do is lift her up to a level of obedience that's not possible for the rest of us. "How many things can Lady Obedience come up with?" Louisa said. "One has to know her and have to deal with her for a long time, not a short time, to truly be able to tell who she is. Brava, brava, Lady Obedience. The more one goes on, the more you make yourself known. As for myself, to tell the truth, I admire you, and I'm even forced to love you. But I cannot help feeling huffy with you, especially when you come up with one of your big ones. Therefore, I beg you, O dear obedience, be more indulgent in letting me suffer. So the big one is that suffering has been taken away, and therefore all these very special visitations of Jesus are taken away as well. So September the 22nd, 1900. Here Jesus is going to tell her that every time she disposes herself to die and go to him, he gives her the merit as if she has actually died. So she's going through death and resurrection all the time on a spiritual level. So I want to give you Psalm 30, verse 5. And Jesus is going to tick her off for being in what in those days was called a melancholic mode. Nowadays we'd call it plain depression. And so in this message, Jesus is going to make it perfectly clear that God doesn't want sad saints. Joy is one of the gifts of the Holy Spirit. As I was all oppressed and afflicted, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus told me, my daughter, why do you remain all immersed in your affliction? That's Luke 24, 17. And Louisa said, ah, my beloved, how can I not be afflicted since you don't want to take me with you yet and you leave me on this earth still? He said, ah, no, I do not want you to breathe this sad air of yours, because everything I have placed inside and outside of you is all holy. Now, I want to give you Leviticus 19:2. You shall be holy, for I am holy, says the Lord. I want to give you 1 John 1:4 and 1 Peter 1:8. Everything I have placed inside and outside of you is all holy. So much so that if something or someone draws near you who is not upright and holy, you feel bother, immediately detecting the opposite stench of that which is not holy. Now, why would you want to shade what I have placed inside of you with this air of sadness? You see, he doesn't want it at all. Because true surrender to the Lord is a surrender in peace and joy. Knowing, however, that as many times as you dispose yourself to make the sacrifice of death, so many times do I give you the merit as if you were truly dying. This must be of great consolation to you, not of all of this sadness. More so, since you conform to me more, as my life was a continuous dying. This is an introduction to something that Louisa will understand, oh, much later at the higher volumes. And that is that she has to go through this death and resurrection, which is, Jesus explains in his passion, but also throughout his whole life, because his passion extended from the beginning to the end. That he had to literally experience everybody's death, okay? And so he himself was going through death and resurrection all the time to try and bring victory to every soul that ever lived. And so Louisa has to conform to him. He wants her to be like him. And so Louisa said, ah, Lord, it doesn't seem to me that death is a sacrifice. On the contrary, it seems that life is a sacrifice. And he disappeared. On September the 29th, 1900, Jesus explains that victim souls are the help and the props that are actually needed for Jesus as he runs the church. I went through several days of silence between Jesus and myself, and with scarce suffering, she said. Now, when she says she has scarce suffering and she's complaining all the time about the absence of Jesus, she's not acknowledging yet that the deprivation of Jesus is her worst suffering. But as we go into higher volumes, that'll become more and more clear to her and to us. I went through days of silence. At the most, it seems that Jesus wanted to continue testing me to make me exercise a little bit more patience. Now, there she has caught on to one of the reasons why the Lord behaves the way he does. And that is that He wants us to respond with more patience and more love and more surrender to him. So on coming, he would say, my beloved, I long for you from heaven. In heaven, I await you. And then he would escape like a flash. And then coming back, he would repeat, cease your ardent sighs now, for you make me languish continuously to the point of fainting. Other times he would say, your ardent love, your yearnings are refreshment for my sad heart. His heart is sad because of the flood tide of sin and iniquity that's poured into it. But who can say them all? He seemed to me that he was feeling like composing verses, and sometimes he would express these even by singing them. Psalm 67, verse 4. However, without giving me the time to say a word, he would escape immediately. Now, Luisa is an Italian, and not being allowed to speak is actually quite difficult. Then this morning, as the confessor placed the intention of having me suffer the crucifixion, notice the importance of placing the intention. I saw the Queen Mother crying and almost contending with Jesus in order to spare the world so many scourges. But he showed himself reluctant, and only to content his mother, he concurred in making me suffer. Okay, so here you have an image of Mary that most of us don't have, and that is as mother of the church and the mother of all believers, that she is very much active in interceding for her children. Then afterwards, as if Jesus had placated himself a little, he said to me, my daughter, it's true that I want to chastise the world. I have the lashes in my hands with which to beat it. But it's also true that if both you and the confessor interest yourselves in praying me and with suffering, that is always a support. And you would come to place as many props in order to spare the world in part at least. So when Jesus said, I have the lashes in my hands, I want to give you Luke 12, 47. So here Luisa is being told that it's not just herself that is involved in this, that the priest has a very active part to play, and that Jesus needs the two of them concurring, because in Matthew 18, Jesus says that if two of you agree concerning any matter, I will ratify it in heaven. Okay. And so that's the two agreeing. Otherwise, not finding the support or props, I will pour myself out with a free hand over the people. And then he disappeared. So Luisa has to learn that the priest has a much bigger role than she is actually acknowledging. So September the 30th, 1900, Jesus asked her to console his afflicted mother. And this again is a new idea. This morning, my most sweet Jesus was not coming, and I had to have much patience in waiting for him. I even reached the point of trying to go out of my usual state, for I felt no more strength to continue it. Now, that's the temptation, not what Jesus is doing. Her temptation to go out of her state is the thing that's very important. He was not coming. Suffering seemed to have fled from me. I felt my senses within myself, and there was nothing left but to add the effort to go out. Now, what Luisa says here is completely amazing to us, and that is she felt her senses, she felt her body, she felt what was going on inside of her. That's perfectly normal for you and me. We would be frightened if we didn't. But she is living at such a high level of union with God and ecstasy that feeling her own senses is something she doesn't have. And so if she comes back to this ordinary state, she feels, oh, I must get out of this. I must get back to normal. But while I was doing this, Blessed Jesus came, and forming a circle with his arms, he took my head in the middle. At that touch, I no longer felt myself within myself. So he's lifted her up again. And I saw our Lord very indignant with the world. As I wanted to placate him, he said to me, do not want to occupy yourself with me for now. For I pray you to occupy yourself with my mother, console her, for she's very afflicted because of the heavier chastisements I'm about to pour upon the earth. Now, here is Jesus deflecting Louisa from thinking about herself and from what's going on or not going on inside of herself. And he gets her to think of Blessed Mother and to try and have compassion and understanding for what our Blessed Lady is going through. So here the attention is being put onto somebody else. October the 2nd, 1900. Fearing that my state was no longer the will of God, she's still in this state of temptation. As Blessed Jesus came, I said, how I fear that my state is no longer your will, because I see that I lack the two main things, which are suffering and your presence. Now, that's her image of herself as a victim soul. And Jesus is going to have to get her to think differently. And he said, my daughter, it's not that I no longer want to keep you in this state, but since I want to chastise the world, this is why I'm not coming and I make you lack suffering, because the suffering would mitigate the chastisements. Now, this is only volume four. And when you get to volume 14, she will still be struggling with this thing that if Jesus doesn't come, I somehow am responsible for it. So this is the thorn in her side that she won't acknowledge. And Jesus said, your position as a victim soul and your continuous waiting for me already break the arms of justice. Now that's Isaiah 40:31. Those who wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like the eagle. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. So he said, what you're going through now is already breaking the arms of justice. In fact, you do not see me, but I see you very well, and I count all your sighs, your pains, and your desires for me. Psalm 62 and Psalm 42. And your being all intent on me is always an act of reparation for many who do not bother about me, nor desire me, but despise me and are all intent on earthly things, covered with mud amidst the stench of vices. So the very life she's living, her commitment to the Lord, her wanting to do anything she can to save her brothers and sisters, that Jesus says is part of your mission as a victim soul. So your state being the complete opposite of theirs, your state comes to break justice, Jesus said. So much so that keeping you in this state and beginning the bloody wars in Italy is almost impossible for me. And Louisa said, ah, Lord, to remain in this state without suffering is almost impossible for me. I feel my strength failing me because the ability to remain in this state comes to me from the sufferings. And so Louisa is saying, if I'm not all occupied with these sufferings, what on earth am I doing in this bed? So since these are lacking, someday when you're not coming, I will try to go out. That's what human nature is like. I'm telling you this beforehand, she said, so you won't be displeased. And he said, ah, yes, yes. You'll go out of this state when I begin the slaughter of Italy. And then I will suspend you completely. So he's telling her that if she goes out of that state, there's going to be terrifying consequences. Now, as we move on from volume four, Louisa will become more and more aware of the sheer responsibility that the Lord has given to her. And in the end, he will tell her that the whole of Europe is resting on her shoulders and she'd really better do her work. While saying this, Jesus showed the fiercest wars which will happen both among the secular, that is society outside, and also against the church. Now here he's showing her things ahead of time, which is Amos 3:7, that the Lord never does anything without telling the prophets ahead of time. And it's also Isaiah 64:10, telling the prophets ahead of time. The blood inundated the towns, Louisa said, like there was pouring rain. My poor heart withered for the pain in seeing this and remembering about my own town. I said, Ah, Lord, in saying that you will suspend me completely, you make me understand that not even for poor Corato will you have compassion. Not even Corato you will spare. And he said, if sins reach a certain number, that's called the critical mass, such they will not deserve to have victim souls. And those who keep you as victim do not interest themselves. I will have no regard for her. That's Corato. Having said this, he disappeared and I remained oppressed and afflicted. Now, first of all, Louisa doesn't seem to be completely aware of the fact that what she's looking at are the disasters of World War One. And between the two world wars, he will show her the disasters of World War II ahead of time. But then when World War II actually happens, he won't talk to her about it anymore. He will just simply keep revealing about his divine will. Now, notice that Louisa is very much concentrated on Italy and Corato. And as we move on in the volumes, the Lord has to raise her her vision, so that she's looking at the whole church and the whole world, and she's not being so provincial. It's understandable to us. It's easy for us to say this because, I mean, we're looking at a text that is completed, but she was going through this on a daily basis and had no idea where it was going in the end. So the Lord says that when sins reach a critical mass, chastisement will happen. So World War One was that critical mass, and World War Two was that critical mass as well. And we're building up to World War Three. So I want to give you Genesis 15:16, where the Lord told Abraham ahead of time that his descendants wouldn't enter the land of Canaan as the promised land until the cup of the Amorites were overflowing. Now, the cup overflowing means that their sins have reached this critical mass. So October 4, 1900, Jesus suffers when he's chastising people because they are made in his own image. After going through a day of privation and of scarce suffering, Louisa said, I felt convinced that the Lord no longer wanted to keep me in this state of victimhood. However, obedience doesn't want to yield to me in this either, and she wants me to continue to stay, should I even croak and snuff out, she says. May the Lord be always blessed, and may his holy and lovable will be done in everything. Then this morning on coming, blessed Jesus made himself seen in a pitiful state. He seemed to be suffering within his members, that is the church, and in his body, that's 1 Corinthians 12, the verses 12 to 31, the church is his body. And his body was being torn into so many pieces, remember the scourging, that it was impossible to count them. With plaintive voice, Jesus was saying, my daughter, what I feel, these are unspeakable pains and incomprehensible to human nature. It's the flesh of my children being lacerated. And the pain I feel is such that I feel my own flesh being lacerated. And while saying this, he moaned and grieved. I felt moved in seeing him in this state, and I did as much as I could to comfort him and to pray him to share his pains with me. He contented me in part only, and I could just say to him, Ah, Lord, did I not tell you, do not lay hand on chastisements, for what grieves me the most is that you yourself will be struck in your own members. In other words, we're the creatures made by God. We're made like him. He has put his own image into us. And she's now saying to him that you're actually striking yourself and striking your children. At this time, there has been no way nor prayers to placate you. But Jesus did not pay attention to my words. He seemed to have something serious in his heart, which he pulled from somewhere else. And in one instant, he transported me outside of myself, taking me to the places where bloody slaughters were happening. Now, this is World War One ahead of time. She sees everything ahead of time. Oh, how many sorrowful scenes could be seen in the world. how much human flesh tormented, torn to pieces, trampled upon as one tramples the earth and left unburied. How many tragedies, how many miseries, and what is more, more terrible ones are to happen. In other words, even I haven't seen the worst, because World War II was worse. Blessed Jesus looked, and all moved, began to cry bitterly, and unable to refrain, I cried with him over the sad condition of the world, so much so that my tears mixed with those of Jesus. After crying for quite a while, I admired another trait of the goodness of the Lord. In order to make me stop crying, he turned his face away from me, dried his tears hiddenly, and then, turning back to me with a cheerful face, he said, "My beloved, do not cry. Enough, enough. What you see serves to justify my justice." Okay, so all these slaughters and everything will justify God's infinite, pure, holy justice upon the earth. So these chastisements had to happen. And then Louisa said, "Ah, Lord, then I am right to say that my state is no longer your will. Why my state of victim if it is not given to me to spare your so very dear members and to exempt the world from so many chastisements?" He's going to explain to Louisa as we move on that human beings can get to a point that if you exempt them from chastisements, they'll actually get worse. And he's going to explain that to her in many different ways. And he said, "It's not as you say. I too was a victim. But even though I was a victim, it was not given to me to spare the world all chastisements. The human beings that caused the chastisements have got to bear some of the brunt of it." In other words, each one of us has to carry the cross. "I opened heaven for it," she said. "I released it from sin." This is the human race. "I released it from sin. Yes, I carried its pains upon myself, but it is just that man receive upon himself part of those chastisements which he himself draws upon himself by sinning. And if it were not for the victim's souls, he would deserve not only a simple chastisement, that is the destruction of his body, but also the loss of his soul. So here is the necessity for victim souls. Whoever wants to avail himself of them, because man is always free in his will, can find the sparing of his pain and the port of his salvation." And Louisa said, "Ah, Lord, I'd like to come to you, that is to die, before these chastisements advance more." She wanted to die before World War I, and she didn't die until after World War II. And he said, "If the world reaches such wickedness as to deserve no victim, surely I will take you. I hope that's not the position we have in the 21st century, because I haven't heard of victim souls around the place." Anyway, let's look at chastisements there for a minute. In these writings, the Lord makes it clear that sin rises up into the heavens. But Hebrews 12:14 says that nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. The book of Revelation chapter 21 and verse 27 says that anything that's unholy has got to stay outside of the New Jerusalem. Isaiah 35, the whole chapter, tells you that on the way of the Redeemer, that the unclean has got to stay outside. So what happens then when sin rises up to heaven? It's sent right back to us as a shower of chastisements. Or if I can put it with a little smile, although it's funny to smile at chastisements, I think there's a post office up there which says return to sender. In other words, we bring the chastisements upon ourselves. And if heavy chastisements come from us, we have demanded heavy chastisements. The victim soul in her intercessions and in her reparations, it's the salvation of souls she's praying for. And in when it comes to the level of World War II, Jesus will actually say to her how many of the soldiers who were killed in the trenches died in grace, who wouldn't have died in grace if they had not died in the trenches. And so the prayers of the victim's souls are actually extremely important, that the chastisements actually bring about the salvation of the souls of the people who suffer. So on hearing this, Louisa said, "Lord, do not permit that I remain here, that is on the earth, present at such sorrowful scenes." And Jesus, almost reproaching me, added, "Instead of praying me to spare, you want to get out of it. If I were to take with me all of my own out of this poor world, what would happen? Indeed, I would have nothing to do with the world anymore. I would no longer have any regard for it." In other words, Louisa has forgotten that the church is the leaven in the dough. That's Matthew 13:13. She has also forgotten that we are the wheat amidst the darnel in Matthew 13:24-30. At volume four, she's thinking far too much about herself and her own circumstances in Corato and in Italy. She's not really thinking on the global level that she will at a later stage. October the 10th, 1900. This, the message here is about love. Now, if you want a summary of the 36 volumes of Louisa, it's divine will and love. God is love, and the divine will is the operative part of the Trinity. So there's no way we can be in the divine will unless we love. No way at all. So while writing, Louisa said, "I was thinking to myself, who knows how much nonsense in these writings? They deserve to be thrown into the fire. If obedience conceded it to me, I would do it because I feel something like a hitch in my soul, especially if they reach the sight of some people, whoever they are. At certain points they show as if I loved and did something for God, while I do nothing and do not love him, and I am the coldest soul that can be found in the world. So here is how they would consider me different from what I am, and this is a pain for me. And since it is obedience that wants me to write, and this is one of the greatest sacrifices for me, I commend myself completely to her, with the sure hope that she will make my excuses and will justify my cause before God and men. But as I am saying this, blessed Jesus has moved in my interior and is reproaching me correctly, because she has, in fact, said a lot of nonsense. He wants me to deny what I have just said, correct? Or to stop writing if I don't do it. He's telling me that by saying this, I have moved away from the truth. While the most essential thing for a soul is never to go out of the circle of truth. Okay? So let me give you a couple of verses. John 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. John 14:17, and John 17:17, consecrate them in the truth. I also want to give you John 8:32, and also verses 44-46. I want to give you Ephesians 6:14, Colossians 1:5-6, 1 Thessalonians 2:13, 1 John 1:8, and 2 John 4. So this is the whole question of the truth. So if we are not in the truth, we're not in God. It's actually that simple. God is truth. So Louisa was sort of being awfully humble, but her humility was wrong because it wasn't saying the truth. Jesus said to her, "What is this? You don't love me. With what courage are you saying this? Don't you want to suffer for me? And Louisa said, all blushing, well, yes, Lord. And he said, well, then, how can you think of going out of the truth then? Because this suffering is for love of him, and it's for love of her brothers. Having said this, he withdrew in my interior without letting himself be heard any more, and I was left as one who had received a heavy blow. Correct. How many devices Lady Obedience can come up with? If it wasn't for her, I would not find myself in these vicissitudes with my beloved Jesus. How much patience it takes with blessed obedience, he says. Now, I resume what I was going to say, since the Lord distracted me a little bit. I love that. Imagine God distracting you. Isn't it the end product of prayer that we would be in communication with the Lord? So, oncoming, blessed Jesus answered my thought, telling me, surely these writings deserve to be burnt up. But do you want to know in what fire? It is in the fire of my love. Because there's not one page. So you need to give yourself a heading here, which is the truth of these writings. Okay, I'm going to write it down myself. The truth of these writings and the truth in these writings as well. So they need to be just burnt up in the fire of divine love, because there's not one page that does not manifest in clear notes how I love souls, both with the things with regard to you, he says to Louisa, and in those which regard the world. And in these writings of yours, my love finds outpourings for my concerned and loving languors. So Jesus is saying that through these writings, he is giving himself an opportunity to tell the world about his broken heart over the way the world, the condition the world is in, and calling that world back to him. After this, Jesus transported me outside of myself and out of the body experience. And finding myself alone without the body, I said to him, my beloved, my only good, what a chastisement it is for me having to return so many times to the body. Because certainly now I do not have one. It is my soul only that is together with you. Now there's a good explanation of the out of the body experience. She explains that what happens to her in these out of the body experiences is truly on a spiritual level only. And that will help you not to misunderstand anything that she says in these experiences. And she said, it is my soul alone that is together with you. But then, I don't know, I find myself imprisoned in my miserable body as though inside of a dark prison. And there I lose that freedom which is given to me when I go out. Now, anyone who has had an out-of-the-body experience or a death experience will tell you that there is immense freedom outside of the body. And when they come back into the body, they feel completely constricted again. Because you are back to the laws governing the material. And when you were out of the body, you were freed from the laws that govern the material. And Louisa said, coming back to the body is a chastisement for me and the hardest one. And Jesus said, my daughter, what you say is not a chastisement, nor does this happen to you because of your fault. Rather, you must know that for two reasons alone, we would say for only two reasons, okay, for only two reasons, can the soul go out of the body. One is by force of pain, which happens in natural death, and the other is by force of reciprocal love between the soul and me. Now, when Jesus was talking, the so-called New Age movement hadn't broken out into the world. That was later on in the 20th century. And they are able to force the body into an out-of-the-body experience by extreme fasting and extreme pain. It's a totally dangerous experience. And so they boast about their interplanetary travel and their interstellar travel and all this kind of thing. But to go into a spiritual experience without Jesus is extremely dangerous, because there's only God and evil. So Jesus said to go out by force of pain should only happen at natural death, and it can happen by reciprocal love in an ecstatic state which many of the saints have experienced. In fact, when this love is so strong that neither could the soul last nor could I endure for too long without enjoying her, I keep drawing her to myself, that is into an out-of-the-body experience. And then I put her back in her natural state again. Now, what Louisa doesn't want is to be put back, of course, because she's all the time wanting to go to heaven. She's very unlike the rest of humanity, who doesn't want to go to heaven for a long, 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 long time. They want to live as long as possible. And that's because the people who want to live as long as possible have not had this wonderful experience of God. And the soul is drawn more and more by an electric wire, and she comes out as I please. He's using the term electric wire because electricity had just been discovered, and the power of electricity had just been discovered on the earth. And what he's really saying is that he draws the soul out and she doesn't have the power to resist. And all of the saints who have had this experience acknowledge that they had no power to resist. And here's how what you think is a chastisement is actually the greatest love. Psalm 115, verse 17. Louisa said, "Ah, Lord, if my love were enough and strong enough, I believe I'd have the strength to stay out there." But of course, it's not given to us to make that decision to go out into the out of the body experience and return. That alone is in God's dimension. And she said, "I wouldn't be subject to coming back to the body. But since it's very weak, I'm subject to these circumstances." And he said, "On the contrary, you're actually wrong. I tell you that this is greater love extracted from the love of sacrifice." Okay. "That for love of me and for love of your brothers, you deprive yourself and return to the miseries of life." Now, that's an exact explanation of 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 to 10. So now once she goes into this out of the body experience, of course, she is shown things that are to come. So that's Isaiah 64, 10 and Amos 3, 7. When I say Amos 3, 7, you'll find in some Bibles it'll be Amos 3, 8, because they just number the verses slightly differently. "After this, blessed Jesus carried me to a city in which the sins committed were so many that something like a fog was coming out, most dense and stinking." Now, if the fog is stinking, it's the stench of sin. "Rising towards heaven." Okay. "And another thick fog was coming down from heaven." In other words, like attracts like. Now we call this chastisement, but she is now seeing what chastisement actually is. This fog, this terrible darkness and fog, you know, you can't see in a fog, was going up to heaven and it came back down. "And it had so many chastisements condensed within it." Now, the chastisements will be the sins revisited to us, "as to seem enough to exterminate this city." Now, it's one city that she's seeing. And the frightening thing is she's looking at the city of Rome. And she said, "Lord, what is this place?" And he said, "This is Rome, where the evils committed are so many, not only by the secular people in society, but also by the religious." That means the people running the Vatican and the priests and nuns, "that they deserve this fog to finish blinding them, deserving their own extermination. Now, that is definitely a forward prophecy because it hasn't happened yet. Okay. The destruction of the Vatican has not happened yet, but it was prophesied to us in 1975 by Ralph Martin at a huge charismatic conference at which I was actually present, and I heard him myself, that Rome would be destroyed. Now, if you go to John's Gospel, chapter 9, you have Jesus healing a man who was born blind. And at the very end of it, I think it's verses 40 to 41, you have the scribes and Pharisees who were, to use our language, the church leaders, okay, saying, "We're not blind, surely." And Jesus said, "If you were blind, I would be able to cure you. But since you say you can see, I can do nothing." And that's the problem with religious leaders. And that's how you know you're dealing with, when she says religious here, you're dealing with religious leaders, that they won't acknowledge any spiritual blindness. Now, if you go to Isaiah chapter 6, verse 9, Isaiah was told that the problem that he was going to meet with among the people of God is that they would see and see and never see. They would hear and hear and never hear because they had blinded their eyes, deafened their ears, hardened their hearts for fear that they would be converted and live. And therefore, the extermination is called for. In other words, you wipe them out. Isn't that frightening? So she's, Louisa said, "In one instant, I saw the disaster that was happening, and it seemed that the Vatican," you see, she's seeing it clearly, "would receive part of the shakings. Not even priests were going to be spared. Therefore, all concerned," she said, "my Lord, spare your beloved city, so many ministers of yours, and the Pope. Oh, how gladly I offer you myself to suffer their torments if you would spare them." And Jesus said, "Come with me and I will show you to what extent human malice reaches." Now, Louisa cannot take it on board that this is something that's going to actually happen and that sin could be at this level in the heart of the church. And he transported her inside of a palace, and in a secret room there were five or six deputies saying among themselves, "Only then will we surrender when we have destroyed all Christians." Now, this is only 1900. And what Jesus does is that he brings her into a place where the communists and the Freemasons are having a meeting, and their decision is to destroy all Christians. So the destruction of Rome was decided in 1900. And it seemed that they wanted to force the king, that would be the king of Italy, to write in his own hand the decree of the death against Christians and the promise of taking possession of their goods. This is what the Nazis did in World War II. You destroy a people, take all their goods, and then you become rich. So you do it by killing and stealing. Saying, these deputies were saying, as long as he would permit this to them, it did not matter if they would not do it for now. Okay, notice the "for now," that is 1900. For they would do it at the right time and circumstance. In other words, both the communists and the Freemasons were people who did global thinking and geopolitical thinking and decision making. And so long as they would achieve their end, they wouldn't mind having to wait. That's very frightening. So after this, Jesus transported me somewhere else and showed me how one of those who are said to be leaders was going to die. So you're talking either about church leaders or state leaders. She's not clarifying this. And this one seemed to be so united with the devil that not even at the point of death would he detach himself from him. All of his strength he took from demons who courted him like a faithful friend of theirs. So here you have the death of the wicked are described, and it's very, very frightening. And it's important for us to really look at this, the death of the wicked. Now, there are many psalms that deal with the good and the wicked. Oh, there must be at least 10 of them. So I'm not going to name them here. If you open your Jerusalem Bible, you'll see the heading, the fate of the good and the wicked, the fate of the good and the wicked, all over the place. So this particular person was so committed to Satan that he took all his strength from the demons who courted him like a friend. On seeing me, now this is spiritually because she's not there physically, the demons were shaken and some wanted to beat me, some wanted to do other things to me. And that's because Louisa wanted to see, could she save this soul? And so she says, the salvation of that soul cost me more. I tried hard and I arrived near the man. Oh God, what a frightening sight. Now she's looking at something spiritual, right? More than the demons themselves, in what a heart-rending state he lay. So you're talking about spiritual darkness and even possession. He aroused more than pity. He was not at all moved by our presence. Our presence is the presence of Jesus and Louisa. On the contrary, he seemed to make fun of it, even at the point of death. Jesus immediately pulled me away from that place and I began to plead before him for the salvation of that soul. But she isn't told anything. She never discovers whether that soul was saved or not. And really all he was trying to show her was how bad things really were. That she was always pleading that he wouldn't chastise. And he's trying to show her that there are some situations in which chastisement is a severe mercy, but it is real mercy. So October the 12th, 1900, I want you to give a heading here, perverted loves. The most powerful enemies of the human being are the love of pleasures, riches and honours. The three things that Satan gives to anyone who serves him are money, sex and power. They're the three big things. And they're the three things that are running the world, money, sex and power. And they're all connected. There's nothing wrong with money used correctly. There's nothing wrong with sex used correctly. And there's nothing wrong with power used correctly. But the problem is they are so powerful and they can be really perverted that Satan uses them to destroy. My adorable Jesus continues to come, Louisa said. So this is October the 12th. This morning, he was wearing a thick crown of thorns. I removed it very gently. I put it on my head and I said, Lord, help me to drive it in. And he said, no, this time I want you to drive it in yourself. I want to see what you can do and how you want to suffer for me. So what Jesus is saying to her is, I want to see how far your love extends. So Louisa said, I drove it in well. More so since it was about showing him how far my love of suffering for him would reach. So much so that Jesus himself all moved, clasped me and he said, enough, enough, for my heart cannot bear seeing you suffer more. And I remain very much in suffering, Louisa said. My beloved Jesus would do nothing but come and go. But that's exactly what Louisa wants. That if she's suffering badly, he will be there all the time. He won't be going away from her. And when he removes the sufferings, he also removes all these visits. So this is a problem for her. And it's going to have to change. After this, Jesus assumed the appearance of the crucified. He shared his pains with me and he said to me, my daughter, the most powerful enemies of man are the love of pleasures. That means the craving for. That's why I said there's nothing wrong with pleasure in the right place. There's nothing wrong with riches in the right used properly or anything. So it's the craving for pleasures and riches and honours. These enemies render man unhappy because they penetrate even into his heart and consume him continuously. They embitter him and they bring him down so much as to make him lose all happiness. Now, as we go on in these writings, the Lord reveals very, very clearly that the divine will is the source of all happiness, all peace, all contentment, and all harmony. So these are the opposite. So if we have these cravings inside of us still, then we haven't gone very far towards the divine will. Jesus said, on Calvary, I defeated these three enemies and I obtained for man the grace to conquer them as well. But of course, we've got to reach out for that grace, giving back to him the lost happiness. But man, who is always ungrateful and always heedless, rejects my grace, and he loves these enemies fiercely. In other words, really attached to them. And of course, we've been told since volume one that we must be detached in order to be free, to be one with the Lord. So man loves these enemies fiercely, which put the human heart in continuous torture. Having said this, he disappeared, and I understood with such clarity and truthfulness these words that I felt abhorrence and hate for these cravings, these enemies. May the Lord be always blessed and everything for his glory. So I want to give you 1 John 2, verses 15 to 17, and Colossians 3, 5. So October the 14th, 1900, we're dealing with wolves in sheep's clothing. This morning I felt so dazed I couldn't understand myself, and nor was I able to go in search of my highest good, as I usually do. Every now and then he would move within my interior to let her know that he was really there, and would make himself seen, and completely embracing me and comforting me, he would say, poor daughter, you are right that you cannot be without me. How could you live without your beloved? And Louisa, stirred by his words, said, ah, my beloved, what a hard martyrdom life is because of the intervals in which I am forced to be without you. She loves him so much, she absolutely cannot tolerate him not being there all the time. You yourself are saying that I am right, and then you leave me. He hid furtively, she said, as if he didn't want me to hear what he was saying to me. And I was left in my dazedness again. Now, this dazedness thing is that she's not completely gone in ecstasy, but she's in a very deep state of union with him. He came out and he said, you are all my contentment. In your heart, I find true rest. And resting in it, I experience my dearest delights. And Louisa, stirring herself again, said, for me also, you are all my contentment, so much so that all the other things are nothing but bitterness for me. And since he withdrew again, I remained halfway through my words, more dazed than before. And this is how the morning went on. I felt as if he was playing with me. Now, he was probably trying to get her to rest as well by keeping her in this kind of semi-ecstatic state. After this, Louisa said, I felt myself outside of myself. So she's in an out-of-the-body experience now. And I saw unknown persons approaching, dressed as middle-class folk. Now, here's enemies coming dressed as ordinary people. Now, the middle class are the ones who keep the whole of society stable. On seeing them, the people were all horrified and screamed at fright and distress, especially the children. And they said, if these set upon us, it's all over for us. And they added, let the young girls hide, poor youths, if they are caught in the hands of these people. So turning to the Lord, I said, pity, mercy, move this scourge away, so dangerous for miserable humanity. Let the tears of innocence move you to compassion. And he said, ah, my daughter, only because of innocence do I have regard for others. It alone snatches my mercy and mitigates my just indignation. Now, that's Matthew 18, verses 1 to 3. Now, Louisa does not say who these unknown people are. So we are left guessing as to whether these people are the communists and the Freemasons who pretend as if they're like everybody else and that they're living normal lives. And behind it all, they're doing the most incredible destruction. There's another thing as well, which only now in the 21st century we can really understand. And that is, if you're told that the children are to hide and the girls are to hide and the young youths are to hide, then you are dealing with the massive invasion of homosexuality, which has spread all over the world and has created terrible disasters, which unfortunately we know too much about today. So I'm going to leave it there for the moment.